The trail was supposed to be safe, wide, open, used every day by joggers, dog walkers, families pushing strollers before dinner. On August 5th, 2023, it became something else. A woman went in alone and never came out. By the time the call reached deputies, daylight was already draining out of the trees. Patrol cars blocked the entrance. Yellow tape cut across the path. What waited beyond it was not an accident, not a fall, not a medical emergency. It was violence, sudden and close. There was no witness, no scream reported, no weapon left behind, only a body pulled off the trail and signs of a struggle that ended where no one could see. Investigators would find DNA that did not belong to the victim. That single fact would push the case far beyond a Maryland park, far beyond state lines, and into a network of crimes that crossed borders and years. But in that moment, none of that was known. All anyone understood was this: someone attacked a woman in the open and walked away. Chapter 1. The trail goes silent. The Ma and Pa trail cut a clean line through Harford County. Gravel path, tall trees, long sight lines in most sections. Locals described it as peaceful, predictable, routine, a place where people went to clear their heads. On the afternoon of August 5th, 2023, Rachel Morin parked her car and stepped onto that path alone. She was 37 years old, a mother of five. Friends later said she liked walking there because it helped her reset. No headphones, no running gear, just a walk before evening. She never came back. A jogger found her body off the trail, partially concealed by brush. The call came in just before nightfall. The dispatcher coded it as an injured person. That changed quickly. First responders saw signs of a violent assault. There were defensive injuries, disturbance in the ground. The scene told them this was not a sudden collapse or animal encounter. This was a homicide. Deputies from the Harford County Sheriff's Office locked down the area. The trail entrance closed. Crime scene tape stretched across a public space that usually stayed open until dark. Flashlights cut through trees as technicians worked outward from where the body was found. The area expanded. More markers went down. Evidence bags filled. Rachel Morin was pronounced dead at the scene. Her identity was confirmed through personal effects and later official records. Investigators notified family members that night. What they told them was limited. The facts were still forming, but the word murder was unavoidable. By morning, the story was public. Residents woke up to squad cars and news vans lining a trail they walked every week. Parents rerouted children. Runners stayed home. The randomness of the attack hit hard. There was no private residence, no domestic call history, no controlled access point. This happened in the open. Sheriff's officials held a brief press conference. They confirmed a homicide investigation. They confirmed the victim's name. They avoided speculation. They avoided details. They asked the public for help. Detectives began building the timeline. Rachel Morin had arrived alone. She was seen entering the trail. No one reported seeing her leave. Her phone activity stopped during the window. Investigators believed the attack occurred. There were no confirmed witnesses to the assault itself. That fact changed the entire case. Without a witness, the scene had to speak. Forensic teams processed soil, leaves, clothing fibers. They documented the area inch by inch. This was not a quick sweep. The terrain was uneven. The light was poor. But the work continued into the night. One of the most critical discoveries came early. Biological evidence recovered at the scene did not match the victim. DNA. At that moment, it was just a profile. No name, no location, no context. But it was clean enough to enter into national databases. Investigators hoped for a fast hit. They did not get one. The profile did not match anyone in Maryland records. It did not match anyone in federal criminal databases tied to the area. No recent parolees, no registered offenders, no local history. That absence raised the pressure. Either the person had never been caught before, or they were not from there. Detectives canvassed the surrounding neighborhoods. They asked about unfamiliar vehicles, about suspicious behavior, about anyone seen leaving the trail in a hurry. Nothing solid came back. Rachel Morin's family began speaking publicly within days. They described her as devoted to her children, active, careful, not reckless. They rejected early online speculation about risky behavior. Law enforcement backed that stance. There was no evidence she knew her attacker, no indication of a planned meeting. the working theory remained an opportunistic attack. That theory made people uneasy. An opportunistic attacker could be anyone, anywhere. The trail stayed closed as investigators continued to search for additional evidence. K-9 units worked the area. No clear escape route emerged. Roads nearby offered multiple directions out. Whoever did this had options. The sheriff's office increased patrols. They coordinated with state police. They kept communication tight, releasing only what they believed was necessary. Behind the scenes, the DNA profile moved through deeper analysis. It was checked against unsolved cases beyond the immediate region. Days turned into weeks. No arrest, no suspect image, no vehicle description. The public began to ask the same question investigators were asking privately. How does someone kill a woman on a public trail and disappear? The answer had not arrived yet, but the case was already shifting. The DNA had not gone quiet. It was traveling, and soon it would come back carrying something investigators did not expect. The trail reopened, life resumed in pieces, but the pressure did not lift because the person who killed Rachel Morin was still out there. Chapter 2, A Name Without a Face. The case did not stall, it widened. After the initial DNA entry failed to produce a local match, investigators pushed the profile outward, state databases first, then federal, then systems that did not belong to Maryland at all. That process took time. Weeks passed without an arrest. The absence became part of the pressure. Public tips slowed, fear settled into routine. Inside the investigation, the focus narrowed to one question. If the DNA did not belong to anyone known in the region, where had it appeared before? Analysts rechecked unsolved cases with similar violence markers. Assaults where the attacker used physical force, left biological evidence, and vanished without a trace. The work was slow and methodical. No assumptions, no shortcuts. Then a hit came back. Not from Maryland, not even from the East Coast. The DNA profile was consistent with evidence recovered from violent assaults in Los Angeles, different victims, different dates, same genetic markers. That discovery changed the posture of the case. Los Angeles authorities were contacted. Case files were compared. The assaults shared traits that were hard to ignore. Sudden attacks, isolated locations, no prior connection between victim and attacker, no immediate arrest. The evidence suggested a pattern. But investigators stayed careful. Similarity did not mean certainty. Only the DNA connection carried weight. As analysts expanded the search further, another confirmation surfaced. The same DNA profile had been linked to violent crimes reported in El Salvador. Those cases involved attacks that followed a familiar structure. Women targeted, isolated environments, rapid escalation, escape without identification. At this stage, law enforcement made a public disclosure. They confirmed that the DNA recovered from the Rachel Morin homicide matched DNA connected to crimes in other jurisdictions, including outside the United States. They did not name a suspect. They did not describe nationality. They did not speculate on motive. They stated one fact only. The same individual was believed to be responsible for multiple violent crimes across borders. Federal agencies entered the investigation formally. Jurisdiction expanded. Information sharing accelerated. The question shifted. This was no longer just about who killed Rachel Morin. It was about how someone capable of repeated violence moved through systems without being stopped. Investigators began reconstructing a travel map based on timelines. When assaults occurred, where the DNA appeared, how much time passed between incidents. The pattern suggested movement, not random wandering, but transitions that followed opportunity. Still, there was no face, no confirmed name, only a genetic profile and a trail of harm. Media attention surged. Headlines emphasized the international link. Public fear spiked again. Parents questioned trail safety. Advocacy groups pressed for answers about screening failures and enforcement gaps. Law enforcement responded with restraint. They clarified what was proven and what remained under investigation. The DNA match was confirmed. The assaults were under active review. No arrest had been made. Behind closed doors, task forces worked through immigration records, travel logs, and border encounter data. That work remained confidential. Officials refused to connect the case to any specific enforcement policy. They focused on one thing only, finding the man attached to the DNA. Rachel Morin's family followed the updates closely. For them, the expansion of the case brought mixed emotions. Relief that progress existed, fear that the scope was larger than imagined, anger that violence had crossed so many lives before stopping in Maryland. Investigators kept them informed, but guarded. They explained that international coordination took time, that evidence had to meet strict standards, that every move would be challenged later in court. As the week stretched on, pressure mounted. The public wanted a name. Law enforcement had one internally, but confirmation required additional verification. Identity without certainty would compromise the case. One mistake could collapse everything. Then quietly, the final confirmation arrived. The DNA profile was matched to a specific individual through advanced forensic comparison. The match met prosecutorial standards. The probability of error was negligible. Authorities now believed they knew who killed Rachel Morin. They also believed he had committed violent crimes before. The man was not in custody, where he was remained unclear. Investigators believed he had moved again. The case entered a new phase, not investigation, pursuit. And for the first time since the trail went silent, the killer was no longer just a shadow. He had a name, and he was still free. Chapter 3, The Manhunt Beyond the Border. Once the identity was confirmed, silence was no longer an option. Authorities released the suspect's name publicly after securing the forensic verification required to stand in court. The DNA match was not partial. It was not circumstantial. It met the threshold used in prior violent crime prosecutions. Investigators stated clearly what was proven and what remained alleged. Proven facts were limited, but heavy. The DNA recovered from the murder of Rachel Morin matched DNA linked to assaults in other jurisdictions. The same individual was connected to multiple violent crimes. What remained alleged was intent, motive, and the full scope of his movements. Law enforcement outlined the suspect's known history based on records and forensic data. They described patterns of travel consistent with the timing of assaults. They did not speculate on why those movements occurred. They focused on where and when. Federal agencies coordinated with international partners. Notices were issued. Border authorities were alerted. The manhunt expanded beyond Maryland and beyond the United States. This was no longer a local case. It was a test of coordination across systems built to share information, but often slowed by borders and procedure. Families connected to earlier assaults began to speak publicly. Their stories carried familiar details. Sudden violence, isolation, no warning, long stretches without answers. Rachel Morin's family joined them in grief, but also in resolve. They spoke about accountability, about the cost of delay, about a system that failed to stop a pattern before it reached their lives. Officials addressed public concern with measured language. They avoided political framing. They emphasized process. They stressed that DNA technology, not chance, had connected the cases. They also acknowledged limits. The suspect had moved faster than enforcement at several points. Each gap represented a moment when violence continued. At the time of reporting, the suspect remained at large. Warrants were active. The search continued. The Ma and Pa Trail returned to normal use. People walked again. Some carried personal alarms. Some stayed in groups. The physical space recovered faster than the sense of safety. Rachel Morin's name stayed. The case ended not with closure, but with a marker in time. A confirmed victim, a confirmed suspect, an unfinished pursuit. Justice in this story was still in motion, and every step depended on finding one man before he disappeared again.